Welcome, everyone, to the Healing of Agape this week. Thanks for listening today. Today we have with us Mario Martinez, and he is the author of the new psychological thriller, The Man from Autumn, which I understand is making its way in Europe, right, Mario?
Yes, it is. It's doing very well in Ireland and the UK.
It's a very interesting book. I think I told you today I hadn't got to finish but about half of it, but I have to say the thing that intrigues me the most is the fact that you've interwoven enlightenment and consciousness in this book, and I've not seen anything else out there like this. How did you come to do this?
Well, I'm a clinical psychologist, but I've studied quite a bit of the mystics, both the Eastern and Western mystics, and I was trying to bring it together because mystics are basically psychologists of the soul. And I was trying to bring modern science, how thoughts and beliefs affect the immune system, with mystical paths. So I thought that I have written many scientific articles that would be very boring for the general public. So I thought the way to do it is just to make it interesting and fun, and write it in the genre of a novel, but indirectly being a novel, really incidentally being a novel, but basically more a book as a navigational chart for the private journey of self.
Now, I have to ask you, did this come about as from something that happened in your life, or did you just kind of make this up?
It's a conglomerate of life experiences and patients that I've known and experiences that I've had, so it's really a conglomerate of things. And also, I had no idea the book is about synchronicity, or what I call the drift. So I thought that I should write it in a way that I would actually learn the process. So I didn't have a predisposed ending or a process. It was just totally coming as it developed, as it evolved. So it was a very interesting experience for me.
Yeah, what I call a drop down of creativity. It always comes at the same, all at one time. It seems to be.
If you're ready to listen to it, then it's all there.
So tell us a little bit about your work, because I know you're doing some work in research as well. Tell us a little bit about that too.
Well, I'm in an area called a big word, but it's psychoneuroimmunology. It's PNI, and that is an interdisciplinary field where you study how thoughts, emotions, beliefs affect your immune system, your nervous system, your endocrine system, and they're constantly in communication. So, by that kind of work, I got involved with investigating stigmata, people that develop the wounds of Christ. And although many are self-inflicted and people doing it for pathological reasons and to get attention, there are some, like Padre Pio and others, that actually defy the normal boundaries of science. And that's where I come in and I investigate these types of phenomena for the Catholic Church. And for the last one that I did was for National Geographic. And these people who have these wounds, some pray for it, some get it. They're 98% are Catholic. When they have them and they're not self-inflicted, they don't get infected. They don't heal. And sometimes they just disappear faster than normal biology would allow it.
How many people have you met that have had that happen?
I've investigated quite a few, but I've only seen three that appear to be quote-unquote legitimate. And since St. Francis of Assisi was the first recorded in the 13th century, there have only been about 350 in all that time, so it's very, very rare.
And you've actually seen somebody yourself?
Yes, actually, the National Geographic has a documentary, and at my website you can see a clip of it.
What is your website?
It's www.biocognitive.com, BIOCOGNITIVE, and that means mind-body. It's a word that I had to invent. But it shows this woman had the sign of the cross on her forehead, and it was the first time in the history of stigmatics that we've been able to do blood work to see how the immune system reacts.
Well, what did you find when you did that?
Well, that the level of stress that this woman should have had was within normal. So the body was responding as if this is a normal thing, which is very unusual. Someone with a wound like that would have a very high level of stress, a lot of cortisol, and that was normal. And then the part that protects the wounds, like neutrophils, which are a type of immune cell, were very, very high. So actually, the wound was being protected, but it wasn't allowing it to heal. and that has to do with some other part of the immune system.
Well, how deep is this wound?
This woman's wound was very deep. It had it was beginning to scar, and it was just a perfect cross on her forehead. And there, in the clip, you can see the actual wound, and me interviewing the lady. But the interesting thing about it is that she had had the wounds also on the wrist and on the palm of the hand 2 years before, and several things. One, anytime there's a stigmatic, there's always spontaneous healing.
Uh-huh.
And around this woman, there were two people that I talked to, the doctor who saw them, and the doctor confirmed that a boy who had leukemia was cured or was in remission. It had been 6 months, and a man who had prostate cancer also. And the physician couldn't understand it. She said that they're not taught those kind of things in medical school. And that happens, I think, because people believe, and believe is a very powerful process that that allows immune function to enhance. So it was fascinating to work on that.
Now, is this woman somebody that seems to be on a spiritual path, or is she just...
No, on a spiritual path. They don't necessarily have to be very religious, but they all are very...
Seekers?
Yes, they're seekers, and they're very spiritual. So I wrote that into the book. Before I did this interview, of course, and in the book, the main character, and it's a novel within a novel, investigates stigmata for the Vatican. So it's a bit of an autobiographical kind of thing. And but it has real science, and it has, of course, fictitious characters. But what I talk about in the science is real science.
That's just amazing.
Yes, it is. And the other thing that happened that was so interesting is when I was there in the middle of filming, National Geographic filming and so forth, this woman begins to have what's called the invisible stigmata, which is the beginning, the pain, excruciating pain without the actual wounds, the beginnings, first stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I had talked to her about changing that model of medieval suffering, of identifying with Christ, or with the suffering of Christ, to actually identify with the ascension, with the love of Christ and the end of the suffering, and that if she wanted to, I could help her with that. So at the time that she was with this excruciating pain on her wrists, I asked her what she wanted to do. I said, I can help you with the pain, or I can help you see if we can resolve this. And she said no, that she really wanted to begin to identify with the love rather than with the suffering. So we did some techniques, some deep relaxation techniques, something that I use for autoimmune illnesses like fibromyalgia and other kinds of illnesses, and taught her how to actually visualize Christ without the wounds ascending. And the pain stopped, and I spoke to her about 3 months later, and it never developed into a full stigmata. So it's the first time that science has been able to really intervene in a psycho-spiritual kind of situation.
So because the pain stopped, the stigmata itself stopped?
Yes, because she changed her belief into identifying with love rather than with suffering.
Well, I'm curious, would it not be possible to have the stigmata without the pain?
No, it's always the pain, because you see, the whole point is to suffer, to feel what Christ felt. So stigmata is never painless. There's always pain and discomfort.
And the other people have you met that have done this?
Two more, a priest and then another woman. So
how old were these people? Were they old enough in age? Were they
No. The
young
woman
people?
In Mexico is 50, and the priest was in his 40s, and the other person was around that age too, more or less.
That's just amazing. Now, you talk a lot about synchronicities in your book. Why do you do that?
Well, because
what is the importance? What do you feel is the importance of a synchronicity?
Synchronicity. I tried to come up with a terminology in the book, and I call it the drift. And it's a dimension that is available to us, because basically complexity theory and chaos theory and quantum physics talk about that. But what is lacking is a common language to be able to understand it and to be able to actually go into it at will. And that's what I talk about in the book, to teach how to get into the secondary attention. And it's not something, you know, real esoteric. It's an everyday kind of thing, because our world is very synchronistic. It's just that we put linearity into it. We make it linear, and it appears to be orderly, but it's only a chunk of what we pick up from our brain.
Well, for people who don't really know what we mean by synchronicity, why don't you explain that a little bit?
Well, the Fern comet's an old term, but it was popularized by Carl Jung, who was a psychiatrist, and he was one of Freud's disciples. And synchronicity means a meaningful coincidence, a highly meaningful coincidence happening.
Can you give us some descriptions?
For example, you are driving around, and you run out of gas in the desert, and you walk to this gas station, and you walk 3 miles to the gas station in the middle of nowhere, and you find your high school sweetheart there.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean that that has to be your soulmate, because they're cosmic jokes. All it means is that you're in the drift. You are in a synchronistic space. And you honor it, and you see what you can learn from it, but it doesn't mean that that's it, that it's your, that is your final destination or the final answer. That's the whole point that people miss, is that they think that if something synchronistic happens, then they have to completely devote themselves to it. It only means you're in the drift.
Do you think that one synchronistic event leads to another?
Well, it makes it easier because you're more in tune. You're more in tune to what I call the second attention, the second intention. And things, as I get synchronistic events happening constantly to me every 5 or 6 weeks.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that there is gradients of consciousness?
Oh, yes.
And what I mean by that is, there appears to me to be, and I don't mean just being awake and asleep, I mean, there appears to me to be, for lack of a better word, gradients or levels, for lack of a better word, because we do have a word barrier here, of understanding I believe that consciousness is contained within some kind of frequency, and for lack of a better word, and the higher your frequency goes, the more knowledge that's available to you. And the easier it is to follow that and understand what's going on in physical reality. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, well, the way that I explain it, I call it bioinformation. That all the information that's there, and it's biological because we're alive. And if you see your brain as a receptor, as like, let's say, a television set, and all the information is there, then you're going to pick up whatever level you're ready for, whatever level you're interested in, or whatever level you're capable of. So it's all there. And the receptors pick it up at whatever level you are. There has to be some training. Sometimes people pick it up intuitively.
Mm-hmm.
Other people, like the mystics, they train themselves to actually get into that axis of consciousness.
Well, what about, do you believe that, have you ever read David Hawkins' work?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that if you're at a particular gradient area, I don't know what the word to call it, frequency level, whatever the word is,
mm-hmm.
if you can understand what I'm saying, do you believe that that's where you are and that you can't jump up to, say, like Hawkins scale 500? You can't make that happen. You can't make that knowledge available. It'll be available when it's ready. Do you think that?
Well, yes, because you see, you always hear about the Zen master who, and the student will say, the disciple will say, well, why can't I have all the knowledge now? And the master says, because you'll burn yourself. That's true. You can't,
mm-hmm.
you can't access information. Your immune system, for example, can't handle levels of joy that you're not ready for. Some people get sick when they actually have levels of joy they don't
mm-hmm.
feel worthy of.
Yeah, I think they've found in research that things start happening when you start approaching the shift, and they're seeing those semi goes, the semi goes, fatigue and depression. Have you found that in your work?
What was that? I didn't hear that.
When you're getting close to a shift in consciousness,
mm-hmm.
there are telltale signs. You know, tumors come and go, sickness come and go, depression comes and goes.
Yes, because
have you found that in your work?
Yes, it's a breakdown of the system because you're overwhelmed with it, and then as you assimilate the information, then the healing occurs. But
mm-hmm.
the problem is that if you don't, you're fixed in that, and that's what's called an illness. That's why. But you see, Western medicine doesn't see it that way. It encapsulates it as something that is there and it's irreversible. In many cases, illnesses are reversible.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to do with the authority, because, for example, placebo works. Placebo is a benign expectation, a positive expectation by something that shouldn't actually have an effect.
Mm-hmm.
But it works in the long run when your culture supports it. If your culture
right.
doesn't support it, then placebo becomes a very temporary thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be a biocultural thing. It has to be a belief, and it has to be supported by authorities in that culture. A physician, a clergy, or someone that you consider to be an authority.
Have you done any research into what particular emotions are caused by what particular illnesses are caused by particular emotions?
Well, there's research in psychoneuroimmunology and that's been done, not necessarily by myself, but there's a tremendous body of information there. Anger is associated with heart problems. Fear, or the type of suppressed fear, is related to cancer. Not all the time, but there are propensities of people who have these illnesses, and they have some what's called a psychoneuroimmunology profile. So it's what they call the C personality, for example, the cancer personality. And, of course, you've heard of type A personality. Mm-hmm. And these are the people that are very, they're always rushing. They want to finish your work before you finish it, and they're constantly rushing. Those are people that are prone to heart problems and cardiovascular kinds of problems.
But go ahead.
No, I was going to say that I also find in my work, in my clinical work, that many people that have autoimmune illnesses like fibromyalgia, lupus, MS, have mm-hmm. problems with setting emotional boundaries with others.
Now, how do you treat people like that?
Well, number one, to find out what it, in many cases they have traumas, they have abuses and things that have happened to them that didn't allow them to learn how to set boundaries early. So I go back to the trauma, help them, not in a psychoanalytic way, but just to help them re-experience it and with some specific techniques on deep relaxation and imagery, and then gradually teach them to set boundaries, to set emotional boundaries, and give people permission to be upset about it when they set them.
How do you think, what mechanism is it that you think maybe interprets these emotions for them to manifest into the body? Do you think that it's some kind of electromagnetic thing that goes on in the body, like energy pulses or something like the work HeartMath is working on? Does that make sense?
The HeartMath is doing some really good work, yes. It's more like, it really is systemic, it's holistic. The immune system will secrete some immune cells by the information that it gets from the hormones, from the endocrine system and the nervous system response. So it's really a combination of things. And you can go into what's called physiological helplessness or physiological empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very holistic. It's a very total system kind of thing. And when a person, for example, when a person is depressed, clinically depressed, they secrete more cortisol than normal people, mm-hmm. which means that they're in a state of I've given up, but in a state of alarm at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Now, what can you do naturally to stop the cortisol from being produced? Is there something you can do?
Yes, of course. There's relaxation
techniques.
Supplements
you can take? I mean, what do you do for that?
One of the problems with pop psychology is that it doesn't look at the deeper belief systems. It tells you, okay, tell yourself you're good, tell yourself you're wonderful 100 times a day, and it doesn't work because the software doesn't believe it. The belief system doesn't believe it. And in depression, the first thing that happens is the person it needs to be aware, not at the intellectual level, but at the experiential level, understanding that they are feeling helpless about something that they can't, that they feel it's a lot, or they believe that it's a lot stronger than they are. So it's a form of giving up. Then, of course, you can have medication and antidepressants and so forth. But then, as the person begins to be empowered, a sense of having control over your environment, then they change the whole psychophysiology. The adrenals are no longer secreting the cortisol that comes from the signal from the brain, from the hypothalamus, and all that. And then the person begins to recover. But to use medication alone, it doesn't work. You have to have medication in some cases, but you always have to have some kind of psychotherapy in order to understand your world, in order to make changes mm-hmm. with your world.
What does someone do who's in the midst of a dark night of the soul, and they're in that desperate stage, you know, where they can't, they're in the stage of blame and it's someone else's fault. They're desperate to get out of it, but they don't accept that it's coming from within. They want to place the blame on the outside. What can you do to get through to somebody like that, to help them?
Well, it's very individual. So it's a very individual process. You have to have a good history. You have to know where they're coming from. But part of it is that the person is not willing to experience their own pain. They're wanting to run from the pain because it's so scary. It's so overwhelming. and you don't get the information that you need in order to come out of the pain.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're in a place that is so uncomfortable, so anguishing, that you don't go in there to really look at the lesson, to see what it is that's going on, to see what got you there, and also to see what it is that you can do. But it's always important to have someone who believes in you. And I think, unfortunately, we as doctors have really forgotten that, and we see people, unfortunately, as lab results rather than individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have a doctor who says to you, we're going to work on this. Let me give you an example. I was in Ireland, was going to go into a television interview, and I was talking to the person who was also going to be interviewed that day, and he was an ambulance attendant. And when I told him what I was doing, he said, you know, something very interesting happened with us that I didn't realize until he started talking about this. There's an ambulance group. There's the one ambulance team in Ireland and in Dublin that has the lowest lethality rate. They save more people than anybody else. And one of the things they do is when they get to the place, they say, look, you're going to be all right. We're going to take care of you, and you're going to be all right. And they even joke. They say, you see this blood here? This is ketchup. It's not blood. And they joke with them. And that alone, what it does is that it creates a physiological empowerment, and it allows the person to work along with whatever medication, whatever intervention they're doing, and reduces the level of cortisol. It reduces the level that goes against the healing process, including heart problems and so forth. So, you know, it's a very interesting thing that are not taught. It's not taught in, no ambulance technician is taught that.
Right. That's amazing that that happens.
Yeah, because you're giving the person a reassurance. You're giving them permission to empower themselves. So they cooperate with the medicine rather than, and look what happens with an ambulance. You get picked up in an ambulance, and there's this loud sound and tubes and things, and all those things are important. But the human aspect is also very important, to let that person know who's scared that it's going to be all right. Even if it's not going to be all right, when you tell them that it's going to be all right, the possibility of overcoming that that emergency goes up significantly.
The power of intention, like
yes.
Gene Radin's work.
Yes, and but especially coming from an authority.
Uh-huh.
That's one of the keys to what I talk about in the book. I talk about the mind-body code. One of the keys is that you have to have permission in order for you to heal yourself.
Well, you brought up something a minute ago that I've kind of been pondering on lately, and that's lab tests. I kind of think that, you know, I'm medical intuitive, and I seem to be able to detect illness in the future. And I'm of the opinion that lab tests are set too low. They set the test to be able to test the things. I mean, to be able to detect the things after the things are already here. Why does science not back those things up some? I mean, for example, I had some lab tests the other day, and some of my leukocytes came back within the normal range,
mm-hmm.
but within the upper three quarters. Well, I know something's going on in my body. That's why I went and had the test.
Yeah.
So why does science not look at those leukocytes are between three quarters and the whole next going to out of the safe zone? I don't understand that.
Well, because they have to go by statistical significance. And you can actually micromanage, or you can micro measure something too much, and it has no meaning. So these are just averages. These are just statistical averages, and you have to take it as not just that, but the whole picture of what's going on.
Don't you think it would help with prevention if they would just back up the important ones like lymph tests and cortisol tests and things like that?
No,
it would seem logical to me.
No, because if you go below that, then it doesn't have any significance. You see, what they found is empirically by finding that if it goes above a particular level, then that would be considered pathological by the damage that it can do. But I think the lab test is just one of many, many things.
Of course.
It's indicating, as you know, to you that something is not going well. But if you take that alone, and sometimes medicine is very reductionistic and it will treat only that rather than the total person, and it doesn't work as well. It has to be very systemic for it to work in the long run.
I still can't understand why if someone goes in and says, I'm not feeling good, and those lymphocytes are elevated, but, you know, 3 points before outside the normal range, I don't understand why people don't look at that.
Well, because when you say you don't feel right, it could be 100,000 different things in your body. If you don't feel right, there could be many, many, many things. And if you reduce it to one measure of something, then you're not looking at the total process. It could be a combination of things going on with a person. And I think the best way to deal with it is just to see what else is going on with a person. I've had many patients who had autoimmune illnesses, or they had depression, or they had different kinds of problems, and no one bothered to ask if they had ever been sexually abused. And in many cases, what they were having is a post-traumatic stress reaction that somehow at some point begins to break down the system, and it could be called lupus, it could be called fibromyalgia, it could be called a variety of things, although each of these illnesses have some specific diagnostics. But in many cases, post-traumatic stress can, for example, mimic manic behavior, or it can create a clinical depression. You treat the clinical depression with antibiotics, and that's not going to do it. That'll help the depression some, but it's not going to resolve the problem, which was the actual case with, and that particular one that I mentioned, it was rape by the father.
One thing I found in my readings, I bet 7 out of 10 people that I read has been sexually abused, particularly by caregivers. And every one of the women, every single one of them, have had breast cancer or breast issues going on. And every single man has had prostate issues or testicular issues. Have you found that comparison?
Very, very high incidence of reproductive organ in the women who have been sexually abused.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because those parts of the body become alienated. We don't know for sure, but we have some theories. They become alienated. They become something that's been disowned, and it's been a source of pain, and it's been a source of anguish. And somehow the body, when you do any kind of alienation to the body, it can have some effects.
And physiologically, what do you think is going on? I mean, what kind of chemicals do you think get released to make that happen?
We don't know, but you know, I'm only speculating. But I think what could be happening is that that part of the body, for example, fibromyalgia, the pain is caused by some particular lack of blood going to parts of the body, like around the shoulders and so forth. And so just like a person can create a stigmata by the micromanaging the immune system and telling the body that you can have 5 wounds in different parts, then you can also create some other kinds of things where, let's say, the ovaries become the enemy. And gradually, the immune system may not be protecting that part enough, and then, you know, you have precancer cells that become cancerous. That's just total speculation, but I think medicine in the future will be able to find those things. That's why stigmata is so interesting.
I do, too. I think they will, too.
Yeah. The stigmata, everyone carries a stigmata. Everyone carries their own pain and their own suffering. And I think that, to me, what I've learned from it has been very helpful in treating patients with other kinds of illnesses.
Well, I want to ask you one more question about illness, then I want to move on. You were talking to me about going down to Antigua to see the priest. Well, actually, I have two questions.
Okay.
One of them is, there is a physicist that's actually doing a lot of research on consciousness, and he told me the other day that he has the muscles in his legs are deteriorating and have been doing so for 20 years very, very slowly. It doesn't matter if he works out, he's on a raw foods diet, he eats healthy, you know, really healthy. And what could cause that?
Well,
could he do about that? Because he's like, nobody's been able to help him.
There's no question that you have genetic predispositions that are there. It's there, but it's a low percentage. It's not as high as people think. So you have a genetic predisposition to something, and then that genetic predisposition interacts with lifestyle, interacts with history. And one of the things that I do when people have these kinds of problems that nobody can do anything about is that I have them, under deep relaxation, not hypnosis, under deep relaxation, identify what they could do if they didn't have this problem. And when they could do if they didn't have this problem, that's what they fear the most. So they fear the joy that they could have.
What do you mean?
For example, this person has a particular problem that is debilitating. They can't get out of the house, they can't do much, and and some kind of autoimmune problem that nobody can pick up what's going on, and no matter what they do. So then you ask them, okay, what would you do if you didn't have this problem? And immediately they say, oh, well, you know, what I could do is I could start traveling. If you would allow yourself, what would you do? And what would happen if you start traveling? Well, my husband doesn't like to travel. Or I have young kids and I can't travel. So the illness becomes almost a way of resolving something that the person can't resolve themselves.
Gives them their excuse they're looking for.
Yes, and many people can't get out of their illnesses because they're not willing to confront what they're doing. I had a patient who was a terminally ill, very rare autoimmune problem.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a lot of problems setting limits with people. So we start working. She lived with her daughter and her son-in-law. She starts setting limits. She starts finding out how to say no to people. But then what happens is that the people that you're co-authoring this problem with will punish you. They don't like it. They're not used to it.
Yeah, they don't like the change.
Exactly. So then she calls me one day after she's doing well. And she said, you know, I don't think I'm going to be able to come back. And I asked her, and she said, I'm just too busy. I have too many things to do. I have to do laundry. I have to go shopping. Right there, I knew that she was rather, she was unwilling to go on, and she would rather die than change.
Right, right.
And then you have to give them permission to go on, you know, and do whatever they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how I think, how I see illnesses. There is a genetic component, no question.
My second question was, what about addictions? How does that play into this?
Well, I have a very controversial way of looking at addictions. I don't see an addiction as an illness in itself. I see it as a social disorder. I see it as a problem with will and self-respect. Now, it doesn't mean that if you say to somebody, okay, you got to respect yourself, it doesn't mean they're going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
But it means that there's a lot of self-hatred, there's a lot of unloving, and the person has not learned the dynamics of will. It's not an illness in the sense that if you're an alcoholic and you're not drinking, the illness doesn't progress. So it's not an illness. It's
what
a disorder.
What about the craving?
What's that?
What about the craving?
The craving, yes. You have a period of detoxifying, and
mm-hmm.
it could be 48 hours, it could be 2 weeks, or whatever it is, whether it's depending on the illness. After that, you have a psychological dependence.
And that's where the will comes in?
And that's where the will comes in, but it has to be taught. You can't just say to somebody, have will. That doesn't work. That would be unfair to the addict. What happens?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I think what happens is the person is distracting themselves from something. And one of the things that I find with addictions is that many, many cases there's a tremendous fear of death. And that's how they, and you see it in the book, I talk about that, how people defy their death by destroying themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have somebody listening right now that's sending me messages that's needing help in this area. And it's actually somebody on a very serious spiritual path, and he's kind of, you know, desperate, not wanting to let that take over his life again. Do you have any other comments for him?
What is the question?
He's an alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
and he's on a very, very serious spiritual path. I mean, he studies under me. He studies under a Buddhist monk that worked with the Dalai Lama some,
mm-hmm.
and he fights this battle with this thing. Do you have any other suggestions for him?
Well, first let me tell you that I will have a suggestion, but it would be irresponsible of me to tell him what to do because I can't do therapy.
Well, he's sending me emails. So
But I will give him some ideas, you know, that he could work with the people that he's working with. One of the things that this person needs to look for, or any person that has that kind of a problem, or any type of problem, is to see what they could do if they didn't have that problem, and that's what they fear.
Mm-hmm.
So learning how to accept whatever they're fearing. And now when you tell people, they say, no, of course, that's not a problem because I really want to be able to travel. Yes, at one level, but another level, if you travel, you're going to hurt someone or you're going to feel unworthy of the joy. See, joy is a very fearful emotion. Joy is a very dangerous emotion if you don't know how
mm-hmm.
to process it.
Mm-hmm.
So what they fear is what they could do if they didn't have the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be addressed. And, of course, there are methods of dealing with that. But it has to be addressed so that you see how you're stopping yourself from joy. It's a form of unworthiness.
An interesting perspective, a good one.
What's that?
An interesting but very good perspective.
Yes, and it's very powerful because that's how I treat addictions. You know, and it's so it's a... But a lot of people don't want to hear it because if you say that you're sick, then you don't have to take responsibility for your behavior because you're sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and I'm not simplifying it, because I know that an addiction is a very difficult thing to fight and to overcome. But I think what happens is that people look in the wrong place for it. It's like driving your car and your oil light goes on and you put in gas instead of oil.
Right.
It doesn't work. You know?
That's funny. Okay, tell us a little bit about your upcoming trip to Antigua. We've got 10 or 12 minutes left. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, in Antigua, what I'm going to do is I was invited to speak to a Catholic clergy on the psychology and even the psychoterminology of evil and of possession. What science has to say about that.
Now, there's a word barrier here. What is evil?
Evil is an act against innocence, the way I describe it.
Mm-hmm.
That's simple. It's an act against innocence. If a person sexually abuses a child, that's evil.
Okay.
You could call it a pedophile, you can call it whatever, but it's evil.
Right. Okay.
And one of the problems that we have also in modern medicine and psychology is that we give everything a title, a psychological or medical title, to take away the responsibility from the person.
Mm-hmm.
When a person commits an act against innocence, it's evil. Now, it could have treatment or not treatment, but it's an evil act, and it's an act that is actually something that hurts the society and the culture.
Yeah, I agree. Some people think that evil, though, is a devil or a demon or something that comes in, you know?
My personal opinion is that evil is within,
mm-hmm.
and that it's accessed from within, and it's always based on fear and profound ignorance.
Mm-hmm. So, tell us what you're going to be talking about down there.
I'll be talking about cases that, for example, of exorcism. And exorcism is very old. Exorcism, you find it in the New Testament with Mark talking about Christ exorcising and so forth. So it's a Christian thing, although some people tell you that it's not. But I think really an illness is a form of self-deprecation. And of course, never forgetting that there's genetics in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would be irresponsible to say, well, when you're sick, you're evil. No, it's not. Illnesses always have a certain amount of shame, a certain
yeah.
amount of self-destruction,
mm-hmm.
a certain amount of unworthiness that actually deplete immune function, and then whatever's going on genetically or what's going on outside. Let me give you an example. Let's say that you were told that to go out in the rain, you'll catch a cold, like, you know, a lot of parents
mm-hmm.
did or do. Well, you will catch a cold, not because you're imagining it, but what will happen is when you go out in the rain, you have been taught that that's dangerous. You begin to secrete cortisol, the immune system is suppressed, and you catch whatever virus is going around. So when my kids were like 7 or 8, they went out in the rain, and I almost, you know, I caught myself. I was going to say, don't go out in the rain because, and I caught myself, and I said, don't go out in the rain because you're going to get wet. And you have to be dried because you pass it on for another generation.
Right, got to break that conditioning
yeah.
there.
So that's an example of, you know, how these things work.
So do you think that there are actual entities that come into people and take over them, or what do you think that is?
I personally don't believe in that. I respect other people's belief in that, but I don't personally believe that they're entities. I believe that it's the person's own doing, their own fear, their own apprehension. Let me give you an example. The voodoo, you've been pretty familiar with
right.
the voodoo hex and so forth. And I
there's
did
a
talk
big
about
article
it in the
on voodoo, and I can't remember what it was, at Time or Newsweek or USA Today or something the other day, about how voodoo is affecting a whole culture because the people believe it.
Yeah, I bring that in, I talk about it in the book in Little Haiti in Miami and so forth, but if you are hexed, and you happen to be in Port-au-Prince and Haiti, and you grew up in that culture, it'll affect you. If
mm-hmm.
you come from another culture, it will not affect you. Another example, and it's called mass sociogenic illness. Mm-hmm. They don't call it mass hysteria anymore because it's not hysteria, it's not hysterical.
Mm-hmm.
There was a case outside of Nashville in Tennessee where, and it was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine, where these football players came to the field, and the coach told them, be careful because the place has been fumigated and there's pesticides, so be careful. 5 minutes later, one of the kids starts vomiting. The other one starts vomiting. They take him to the hospital. No toxicity. They come back. The coach is very upset. He goes to the head of maintenance, and the head of maintenance says, I know. I'm sorry. I forgot to tell you that we didn't fumigate.
Amazing. Well, let me ask you this. When I first started, you know, I get what I get in my head from whatever source, I call it source, but when I first started doing it, some of my friends would warn me, oh, you need to protect yourself, you know, you're going to have entities come in you and take over you, you're opening yourself up, and I just think that's nonsense. I said, if I have entities in me, why would I have such accurate information? They'd be giving me bad information to help people if I were having these negative entities come in me. Do you think that's nonsense, too?
Well,
I mean, I didn't believe it, so I don't get affected by it, and they think I'm crazy.
It's not in the sense that it can affect you if you believe it, but you're going to be believing, for example, that Tibetan Buddhists have their own ways of protecting themselves. The Tibetan Lamas protect themselves from evil entities, and they believe in evil entities. Mm-hmm. If your culture doesn't believe in evil entities from the beginning, then you don't need to protect yourself. If your culture comes from that, then you protect yourself with whatever rituals there are, because it all has to do with a personal belief, but it's not just an intellectual thing. You have to see that your culture is within your fabric of your biology.
You have to protect yourself.
Yes. It depends on, for example, if you consider that the cross is your protection, then it will be your protection.
So in other words, your own mind creates your own reality there.
That's right, I think.
So what is the receptivity of the Catholic priest and the world that you're presenting this to?
Well, for example, the Vatican doesn't consider stigmata to be divine intervention. They leave it open to the individual. Mm-hmm. And Padre Pio was not canonized because of the stigmata. That's not one of the criteria. So the Catholic Church wants to have scientific understanding of things because they don't want to create circus atmosphere. And neither in the stigmata nor the possession.
But now let's make this clear here. The Catholic Church is actually asking you for some scientific research or study or evidence, right?
Yes.
They're opening up to this,
is
what I'm saying.
Yes, because they want to look at the science also, not just... Now, they do believe in entities, of course. The Catholic Church says that Satan can possess and so forth. But they also look at the scientific aspects of, especially to rule out people who are pathological, mm-hmm. who think that they're possessed and they're going through a psychotic episode, for example.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what about these people that believe that they have... what about these people that once believe that they have chips placed in their heads and things?
Well,
I know, I had to stop that too.
I don't know. What I would do is I would ask them to have an MRI and see if the chips could be seen in the MRI. And in that way, we'll all know.
I just thought about this woman that kept calling me one day, telling me that she had this chip in her head. And I'm just, it's all in your head, lady.
That would be one way to check it out. Do a functional MRI and you could see something if it's there.
Well, Mario, we've got about 5 minutes left, so
okay.
What I'd like for you to do is talk about the importance and the things that you're really trying to convey in your book.
Well,
and,
first...
tell people where they can get it.
Okay,
and,
they can Amazon or many of the bookstores have Amazon.com or my website, www.biocognitive.com. And it's biocognitive, biocognitive.com. It can be ordered there. But in the book, let me give you just a little bit of information here so you can see how we kill joy. All of the publishers that rejected my book, and you know, you have to have a strong ego.
Right,
all
I
of them
about
said,
3,000 submissions.
Yes, they said that it was a very well-written book, but it was too happy.
Are
and
you
I needed
serious?
To have more suffering. So the book is really about bringing hope. But bringing hope with substance, not just bringing hope with pseudoscience or pop psychology. Bringing hope and teaching people, for example, about that growing older doesn't necessarily mean that you become weaker. That if you are and from an ethnic minority doesn't mean that you don't have the opportunities. That relationships can be honorable. That monogamy could be very erotic. So many things to really teach people that we're here to learn about joy, not here to live in a world of suffering. And that sounds very Pollyannish, but it's not. It's substantive, and, and, and you can have access to it if you want to. So it's basically a chart to teach you how to navigate into finding joy in your life.
Well, I think it's amazing. I really do. I think it's a great book. When I get, you know, I get books from everybody that comes on my show, so I'm constantly having to read something. But when I pick it up, I can't put it down.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad that you're enjoying it.
It's a one-of-a-kind thing out there, I have to tell you.
Thank you.
It's refreshing to see it come on the market.
And you wouldn't believe how much I had to fight for that book to be as positive as it is. And by the way, as you know, because you've been reading it, there are problems that these people aren't perfect. They have sufferings and they have things in their life, but they don't dwell on it. They don't rerun it, and they move forward. And that's the whole point, that you move forward with the right tools and you don't become a chronic victim.
What about living in the moment?
Living in the moment is very important. You have to, of course, look at your history, but living in the moment, because that's all you have. You know, like Carl Jung said, I'm not what's happened to me. I am what I choose to become. And that's very helpful for people that have come from anguish.
Do you have some tips about how to get in the moment?
How to get in the moment is to stop
rehearsing.
Books
are good about saying, get in the moment, but nobody tells you how to do it.
Well, the first thing is when you get in the moment, find out what's going on in that moment. And you will see that if you're not in that moment, what's happening is that you're constantly putting yourself down, or you're constantly preparing for a battle, or you're constantly looking at your unworthiness. So who wants to be in that kind of moment?
Right.
So what you do then is you begin to change those things that get you away from that moment that you create, and you'll find that you'll spend more and more time in that moment because it becomes more pleasant. Nobody wants to be in a bad place. But as you said, you have to find ways to do it. You just can't say be in the moment if your moment is terrible.
Yeah. So let me ask you one more question, because you know I'm working on this project of figuring out how to define these gradients of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got just a couple of minutes. What is your definition of consciousness? And explain why that's your definition, because there's so many of them, but do you think there are gradients? And what is your overall view of what consciousness is?
Well, from what we know in cognitive science and neuroscience, is that there are different levels. For example, when people have certain types of brain damage, they even, in some cases, lose identity of self. They don't even know who they are. They cannot identify fear if you have problems in the amygdala and so forth. So consciousness is an awareness, and the level of awareness has to do with, in a normal person, with how much they perceive, how much they allow themselves to see. And the brain was designed to work with new information for the next 10,000 years. But we don't use the potential that we have. What we do is we stay in a very limited moment, and we don't realize that there's a lot more than we think there is. And, yeah, there are gradients, because it's how much you allow, what I call horizons. How much you will allow yourself to experience, how much you will allow yourself to perceive, but also, more importantly, how much you allow yourself to believe.
I guess I've been having this dialogue with some people online about this, and they just think that I'm crazy because I say there's gradients of consciousness. And then they'll jump to the fact, well, what difference does it make? Well, it really doesn't make any difference, except helping define these things, help people realize that they exist, and can help bridge the gap between science and spirituality.
Oh, of course.
How can somebody have a dialogue on this and pursue quantum mechanics in search of consciousness if they don't even have a meeting of the minds about what they're talking about?
Well, there are gradients, and a very simple example is when a person goes into deep meditation. Not only do they lose the sense of self and the sense of boundaries and everything, but all kinds of things happen in the brain. They go into theta waves, which is a very deep level. The brain stem doesn't respond to noise on the outside.
Really?
Many things happen when you go into meditation, especially with Tibetan Lamas. There's been a lot of research with what they call functional MRIs, to see how their brain is working when they go into deeper. Sometimes they'll breathe one breath a minute, sometimes one breath every 2 minutes, and they're getting the oxygen and everything.
That's amazing. I'm so glad to hear you say. I mean, most of the materialist scientists that I interview don't think that there is gradients of consciousness. It's been real interesting listening to this. The open-minded people like Dean Radden, Bill Tiller, Brenda Dunn, they all think there's gradients of consciousness.
Well, there is, but a lot of scientists are very narrow-minded, and they're not real scientists, they're technicians. Because if you're a scientist, you have to be open, and you have to test theories and see what the theories bring out, what they unfold.
I think it's important for them to realize that their work today is good, but it's not finished.
Oh, it'll never be. I mean, in the 1900s, just before quantum physics became very well known and became evolved, the chancellor of the at Harvard University said, "Don't go into physics. We already know everything we need with Newtonian physics."
That's exactly right.
But
they can't tell us why things act like a particle and a wave at the same time, but yet they're finished.
Yeah, well, it's complementarity, of course, but these are the things that Newtonian physics cannot explain because it was not designed for that.
Mm-hmm.
It was designed for big things, but when you go to small things, all the rules are broken when you go subnuclear.
Now, do you think that consciousness would be that irreducible unit?
Yeah.
Do you think there is an irreducible unit? I mean,
yes,
there
is.
What do you think about that?
There is. And it's something that the zero-point unit that they talk about.
Yeah, that was my next question.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a form of communication that was unheard of. They thought that at zero point, the freezing point, or not freezing point, but the lowest point of that you can reduce something in temperature, that there was no movement of molecules or anything, and there is movement.
Do you think that consciousness would be the void that everything lies on top of? Does that make sense?
In quantum physics, the void is everything. It's the
mm-hmm.
space is basically interwoven. But
go ahead.
But I think what happens is that our brains constantly look for linearity, constantly look for sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look for sequence, you can only get a certain part of the reality. When you go beyond that, and that's what meditation is about, is to go to levels that allow you to integrate things that you normally couldn't if you, in a logical, quote, logical world. Like left brain is just very, very logical.
I got one more question, and I know you're not a physicist, but I want to ask you this question anyway, because it's came up in a debate that I've had with somebody lately. You know, people say we live in a hologram. Physics supports the horizontal energy lines. We know that. But they don't support there being vertical energy lines, from what I understand. It seems to me that if we live in a hologram, there would have to be vertical lines of energy, which would also support the fact of ascension and gradients of consciousness. Do you think so?
Well, look, what happens is that we create a model of the brain or of consciousness as far as our discoveries have taken us. Early, and when you read neurological books and books about the brain, they look at it as a mechanical process. Then the telephone was invented, and they look at it as a telephone. Then the computer, and then the hologram. So it keeps going on and on. As you said, it's never finished. So we create models of what we know. And
well,
when we don't know, we assume that it doesn't exist.
Well, it seems only logical to me. I mean, if you're going to weave a basket, which is what a hologram is basically, weaving, you have to have horizontal lines. I mean, you have to have those strips of stuff you weave the basket that go horizontal. You have to have strips that go up and down. Why would it would have to be that way?
Well, but in a mechanical sense, it would. But the whole point is that that some of these things are not reducible. They can't
yeah.
be reduced. So they're irreducible. So when you try to put it into a mechanical model, you get lost.
Yeah, there's something missing.
Yeah, it's not mechanical. It's an irreducible process, and that's maybe what consciousness is. It's a level that by definition cannot be defined. Our brains can come up with problems that it can't solve, which is the beauty of the brain. It's the most beautiful instrument there is.
Well, we're out of time, Mario. Great show. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. I wish you'd come back sometime.
We will. Thank you.
Wish you'd write another book about all those things you've been talking about the neurological process.
I'm working on that.
Interesting. Take care, honey, and come back.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.